Good evening, America. Welcome to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. How you doing tonight?
Doing good.
Awesome, awesome.
If you'd like to take part in the program this evening, if you'd like to make a comment or if you have questions, our number is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. The team here, Cliff, Ethel, and I, we are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. So please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed during the program, expressed by the callers or the guests, do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, thank you for tuning in and choosing to spend time with us this evening here on the program. You know, we have a great lineup this evening. We are going to be talking to the attorney for Khalif Browder. We'll dive a little bit more into that program or into that story. It's about a young man who was incarcerated in New York and charges never brought up, and spent several months in prison and then just released mysteriously, again, with no charges being brought up. But we'll dive into that a little bit. We're also going to talk about juveniles wrongly convicted and sent to adult prisons as well. You know, that's a major problem, and that's something that we want to talk about. As usual, we have our current news. We also have our exoneree moment. And then, you know, we always talk a little bit about the IRP-6. That's the basis for which our program was started, the IRP-6 being six IT executives who started IRP Solutions Corporation, that being Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper. And these gentlemen have been wrongly incarcerated now for going on 20 months. We're going to talk a little bit more about that in a little while. Mm-hmm. If you'd like more information about the IRP-6, we ask that you would go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. We also have a petition out on change.org. And then if you'd like more information about a Just Cause, you can go to www.a-justcause.com and find out more information about a Just Cause. We also ask that you would assist us with donations. We're trying to build our donor base right now. Mm-hmm. We have a donate button on the website, so click that button. Also, if you'd like to listen to more of the archive programs, you can go to ajcradio.com or live365.com. All that information is out on our website. Again, our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. For our regular listeners, you know what that sound means. That's the AJC Radio Breaking News. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
we had some exciting events going on this past Thursday. So what do we have going on Thursday, Ethel?
Oh, my God. This is just awesome, you guys. We were up in Denver, Colorado, where none other than federal judge Christine Arguello was being honored by the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame. Did you hear what I said? I said Hall of Fame.
It should be Hall of Fame.
It should be Hall of Shame. Do you hear me? But anyway, we were up there. It was over 100 of us, you know, and we were picketing and marching and protesting against her being honored for the in the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame. This is a judge who has sent six innocent men to prison, basically trying to destroy their families, and she's being honored. She's withheld over 200 pages of the trial transcript.
Yep, yep.
These guys are now sitting wrongly convicted in a federal prison camp in Florence, Colorado, and this rotten judge has withheld over 200 pages of the trial transcript, and she is going to be honored in the Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, one of the best sights that I think that you could have had in that protest. And Cliff and I, we went up on one of the parking garages.
Yes.
And we were able to look and you know, to have people on each corner.
Yes.
And this was at the downtown Marriott in downtown Denver. And to have people, you know, basically anchoring the Marriott Hotel and with signs and bullhorns, flyers, people out there, you know, getting the petition signed.
Yes.
And, you know, out there, like, we were out there like an hour before the event started.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, got a lot of attention from the people who were actually going to the event.
And people off the street that were actually participating in our protest.
Yes.
You know, and they were like, oh, yes, I'd be happy to sign the petition, or 200 pages. You know, if you know nothing else, you know that 200 pages of a transcript missing, there's a problem.
And, you know, the thing is, too, Ethel, is that, as you stated, people actually, when they stood and listened to what the story was about.
Yes.
You know, some folks said, well, you know, they may have been able to do something, you know, as far as some of this other stuff, but 200 pages?
Okay.
I mean, that speaks volumes.
I mean, it stood out just by itself. You really didn't have to say much of anything else. That stood out by itself.
And you know, and then we had the petition.
Yes.
And so that, you know, I briefly talked about change.org. And so, you know, we have the petition out there on change.org, and people can go out there, do a search on IRP6, and the petition will come up specifically for the 200 pages, where we're trying to get enough signatures where we can go forward to our legislators, to the Department of Justice or whomever.
Yes.
You know, and say, hey, you know, this many people in the community are saying that something is wrong with this.
Exactly.
Some action needs to be taken to get these pages of the transcript released. You know, and I think even just right there, you know, in the short time that the protests occurred,
right,
there were over 300, between 300 and 400 signatures obtained.
Yes.
And then on top of that, I have it, I have my phone set up to receive when we get another signature on change.org. I'm about to disconnect that that feature. My phone is getting blown up. I mean, all through the night, all day, it's just so-and-so has signed your petition on change.org. It is absolutely amazing.
Sam, you know, one of the great things about that is a lot of the people may not have signed it right then while we were there, but they were asking for the information so that they could do that when they get home, or they have the time that they could sit and sign the petition.
Yeah.
And you know, there were so many people that were saying, yes, absolutely, I'd be happy to sign this. And I'm so glad that somebody came out and told us, well, you know, she's inside and she know y'all talking about her out here.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the point.
Yeah, yeah.
That is the point.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you can get honored for your accolades, things that you've done, but when you cross the line and start doing things that are dishonorable,
that's right,
then that needs to be brought to people's attention.
That's exactly,
you know,
right.
I was thinking about that earlier today. We have, you know, people who have been in prominent positions all throughout our history. You have sports figures that, you know, they were like the sports heroes of their time.
Yeah.
But if they crossed the line on legal matters, none of that mattered anymore.
That's exactly right.
And the same thing should apply to you know, our congressmen, our legislators, our judges, attorneys.
That's right.
Everyone should be held to the same standard of accountability. So, Ethel, what else are we asking people to do as far as helping out?
Absolutely. And you know what? I just want to throw this out here again and tell people that are listening out there, please grab a friend, grab a couple of friends. Tell them to pick up that phone and call Eric Holder's office. He's the United States Attorney General. And tell him to investigate what has taken place with that missing over 200 pages of transcript. His number is 202-514-2003 and 2005. Call him, grab a friend, and have them call as well.
And then also, you know, we have been making a plea to the jury who was in the IRP6 case, Cliff. And so, you know, I know a lot of times we bring it up later in the program, but, you know, folks who sat on that jury, what are we asking them to do?
Yeah, I mean, we realize and we ask them to basically get in touch with us because, as Ethel was saying, you know, when you got over 100 people picketing a judge for what she did in a courtroom, and then when you have people on the street saying, hey, you know, I'm going to sign the petition because this is wrong.
That's
and
right.
One of the things, and we were talking about this before the show, that, you know, even the people who didn't understand everything about the case, who didn't know what was going on, you don't even have to be the average American. Any American It's like you did not provide over 200 pages of my trial transcript. So there's 200 pages of information that's missing. There's a reason for that, and that has to be illegal. You don't even have to know anything about the law. You don't have to have been involved in any type of case. You know, as an American, like, you guys are hiding 200 pages of the transcript. Something is going on. And for people to look at that and say, this is the judge that's responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she not only was responsible for that, that's one of the issues during this trial.
Yeah.
And so she also didn't give the jurors all the evidence that they asked for.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't allow expert witness to testify. And so the jurors that are out there, we're asking you, get in contact with us. All of the things that Judge Arguello didn't give you, all the lies that she told you, every piece of law that she broke, that she twisted, that she gave to you in the wrong manner, we'll lay it out to you black and white, show you in the law books what it says, not just because a judge said it. A judge should be held accountable for what she does and her words. And so we're asking you to get in touch with us. Ask any question that you want. We'll give you the answer. Anything that seems like it was an issue at the trial, or you have a question, you ask it. We'll provide you the answer. We'll give you all of the evidence, anything that you ask for pertaining to this case.
Okay, and then, we've talked quite a bit about the petition, and again, we ask that you go out to change.org, do a search on IRP6, sign the petition as you're listening to the program tonight, put in a comment in there as to why you're signing the petition, and as Ethel said, hey, call a friend, tell them to sign it up. Also, call a friend, tell them to tune in. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, and you can actually participate in the program by calling us at 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. All right, we got a new segment that we're going to start on the program. And, you know, there are a lot of things pertaining to the IRP 6 case that, you know, it kind of boggles the mind. And, you know, we were talking about it, and we kind of reflected back on the Arsenio Hall show where he used to say, hey, you know, I was driving into work today, and, you know, I was thinking about this or I was thinking about that. And these are things that make you go,
Yes.
So this is our things that make you go, segment related to the IRP 6 case. Now, you know, listeners, if you think that we're hammering this thing about the 200 pages of missing transcript, then, you know, you're right, because that is a vital point in this case.
Yes.
There's absolutely no reason why over 200 pages of a transcript should be missing. Now, the thing that's going to make you go, okay, now, you know, we've been talking about how the Fifth Amendment violation occurred, and the IRP 6, mm-hmm. There was a sidebar. Judge Christine Arguello, she called a sidebar.
Right.
And during the sidebar, she compelled the guys to take the stand. At the moment that happened, she knew that she violated the Fifth Amendment right.
Right.
I mean, there's in the transcript, there's back and forth dialogue that talks about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when the guys requested to have the transcript delivered that showed the sidebar,
right.
The sidebar portion was missing. Now, do you think it took 200 pages of a transcript to cover that sidebar?
Absolutely not.
That's the right there. That's the
There you go. I mean, and so it makes you question, what else is in those 200 pages?
That's right.
I mean, what else is Federal Judge Christine Arguello hiding, providing.
Nah, that's right.
What's being withheld in those 200 pages of transcript?
See, all of that makes you go,
It does.
It really does. It makes you think about what is it? It's got to be something.
Exactly.
It's got to be something that maybe, you know, the IRP 6 hasn't thought about, we haven't thought about, but they know that it's there.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And with the passage of time, you know, the IRP 6, you know, there's so much data and so much stuff that's been covered,
mm-hmm.
you know, they may not remember all that.
Exactly.
And you know, we have reviewed many, many pages.
That's right.
Of transcript pertaining to this trial.
That's exactly right.
And 200 pages? Oh, you bet. There's more than just that sidebar there. So, you know.
And that's why I was saying, you know, the average person looks at this and says, I don't care what happened. You're withholding 200 pages of transcript? that's a crime.
Exactly.
That
that's right.
Be dealt with.
That's
exactly.
Right. Now, and we got a list of things here, and we're going to bring them out from time to time. But let's do a second one off of the list of things that make you go, hmm. Okay, so the IRP Solutions was conducting regular business, right?
Right.
And so in conducting regular business, you got business prospects, you got the Department of Homeland Security, you got the FBI, you got NYPD, and then even later on, you got the Bahamas, you got Trinidad, you got Colombia.
Yeah.
But in order for the government to make their case work, they had to, you know, stifle the progress of IRP Solutions.
Absolutely.
That's right.
So how can you have the government going around to all of the IRP Solutions prospective clients
right.
and customers and saying, don't do business with this company because they're doing some crooked stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the government is accusing IRP Solutions of doing crooked stuff,
mm-hmm.
but you're going to their prospective clients,
okay.
prospective customers. I mean, how can there be a fictitious company that is doing fraudulent business, does not have a viable product, and is not a legitimate business? So how can they have customers?
Hmm.
And yeah, exactly. And so you're going to their customers and saying, don't do business with them. Now you're preventing IRP Solutions from generating revenue, end up paying the debts, because
exactly.
this thing is about debt anyway.
Exactly.
And then you have the FBI agent, John Smith, in the courtroom
yes.
saying that, well, if IRP Solutions had paid their debts, we wouldn't be here.
And you know what really just mm-hmm. makes your blood boil about that is because here's a judge hearing that. Hearing the FBI is like, okay, so you pull off a raid where you basically lied, saying
mm-hmm.
they don't have any software.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, but then you said you talked to their potential customers about the software they saw and how good it was.
Exactly.
So you're caught in two lies right there.
Exactly.
And then here the judge should have said, wait, did you just say that if the bills had been paid, that we wouldn't be here? Yes, that's what I said, Your Honor. Well, then this seems that this is a debt collection case.
Exactly.
And I'm going to throw it out. That should have been the end of the
Absolutely.
Whole thing right there. But
that's it.
Having a crooked judge
okay.
by the name of Christine Arguello.
Yes.
That crooked judges, what do? Crooked things.
Christine Arguello, Hall of Shame.
And you know, Gary Walker, one of the IRP six, he has stated several times that, you know, IRP was on the brink of closing business when the raid occurred.
Yes.
And so you're on the brink of closing business. And then, and I often refer to it as the government orchestrated the
yeah.
whole thing.
Exactly.
I mean, from the raid all the way down to everything else. And so when you are in control of, you go to folks and say, don't do business with them,
mm-hmm.
then, yeah, you're gonna set it up to where they can't generate revenue, so they are going to still be in debt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So now you come in with this case and you say, hey, you know, they are so much in the hole. Now, they didn't use the term debt except for, like you said, FBI agent John Smith.
Right.
I mean, he said it on more than one occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
it's obvious that this thing was about debt. And so, you know, it's you know, like we said, you know, things that make you go, And so it's – and if folks want to get more information about the IRP 6 and this case, you're going to see more stuff out there that's going to make you say,
Exactly.
So go out to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org. Our phone number this evening is 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about some other things that are in the news. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Don't go anywhere.
Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Thanks for staying with us. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Thanks for joining us this evening, folks. And so let's go to the news, Ethel.
Yes, absolutely. You know, I was looking at this one article, and San Antonio, well, Texas again, of course, okay.
That's right, our favorite country.
Yes, it's titled San Antonio Lawyer Bribed Bexar Judge. And it's talking about this lawyer who kept bribing this judge to rule favorably for his defendants, for the people that he was defending. And it says he was bribing a state district judge, admitting that he gave the jurors cash, paid for repairs of his personal vehicles, even selling one of his Mercedes for him, all in exchange for favorable rulings on his cases. Now, this judge, he was then the 144th district judge, Angus McGinty. Okay, this man ends up, he gets to resign in the midst of the investigation. Nothing happens to this man.
Yeah,
nothing.
And when I was reading this, that was my thing. I'm like, where? I was looking for the rest of the article. Like, where is the part that says where the judge went to jail, he got sanctioned, something. There's nothing about the judge except he resigned.
Exactly.
It's like, no, where is he?
Yeah.
Wasn't there a picture of him on the front of the
that's right.
of the San Antonio newspaper?
How could he be allowed to resign in the midst of the investigation? Even?
And see, that's that immunity
that's that pompous elitist
no
attitude about it, really.
There is no words for it. Oh, I'm caught. Hey, I was taken bribe. And when you think about it, they said, let's see. They said, Acevedo's, mm-hmm. this is the guy who got caught. His mm-hmm. plea deal states, in exchange for these bribes, Judge McGinty provided favorable judicial rulings, mm-hmm. which benefited me and my clients. Judge McGinty provided these favorable judicial rulings as requested and as opportunities arose. These favorable mm-hmm. rulings included leniency at sentences and less restrictive conditions of release. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. what about the other side? Now, if this judge was taken bribes mm-hmm. from one man, you know he's taking them from everybody else. He's like,
funny.
Oh, if you want to get your client out, if you want somebody to spend, you know, 20 years in because you don't want to see him again,
right.
You know he did all this. It's like every case that he presided over
uh-huh.
and that he ruled on should be reversed.
And look, now the judge is allowed to resign. He's gone about his business, living his life, whatever. This lawyer, What is this name? Acevedo? That was him, Acevedo?
Yeah, Acevedo.
Well, anyway, the maximum penalty for bribery is 10 years in prison. But Acevedo's plea agreement shows he's likely to get less than that because prosecutors intend on giving him credit for taking responsibility.
Right.
Now,
are you lying?
And that's responsible.
You know, I took responsibility. So
no, I got caught.
Yeah,
exactly.
Okay.
I got caught. Now, I'm sorry. I'm going to take a plea deal. Now, if anybody in this room, any of us said,
okay.
you know what, I was taking bribes, I bribed a judge, this and this and that, but since I'm cooperating, I want some leniency. You're not getting no leniency. There
I'm
is no
you.
No normal citizens get leniency from the court for doing nothing.
Exactly.
If you look at it, they get the same charge no matter if they cooperate or
that's
not.
Exactly
that's
exactly right.
That's a fallacy.
And that goes to tell you when you got people that goes and turns themselves in when they've been looking for them for committing a crime and they go and turn themselves in. You still getting life in prison, fool.
That's
yep.
right.
Okay. Oh, you still getting life in prison.
You didn't even do it and they still going to lock
you up. I'm telling you.
Okay, that case, that story is actually, you can find more information about that one out on Express News. And you got another one here, Ethel, that is talking about government lawyers committed egregious misconduct.
That's some crazy stuff with that particular case. This man, what is his name here? His name is Royer, is Randall Todd Royer, has served a 20-year prison sentence after he admitted helping individuals gain access to a terrorist training camp in Pakistan.
Wow.
Okay. Now, the lawyers in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, they say committed egregious misconduct in their handling of discovery in a lawsuit that challenges how the Federal Bureau of Prison treats inmates classified as terrorists. Now, the thing that I that gets me with this one is this judge Lambert, he said, I would hold a hearing in open court to hold the government attorneys accountable for their misconduct here. We can't even get six innocent men's case looked at and done right here in the United States, and they ain't nowhere near no terrorists. They're not even committed a crime whatsoever. So how in the world, explain this to me, you going to go about trying to help clear somebody who has been labeled a terrorist when you got innocent people like the IRP6 that are sitting behind prison, hadn't done a cotton-picking thing, and we can't get the judge to do right by them?
Yeah, that's what's crazy. This man, he's not arguing that.
He's not.
You know, he's not arguing that he committed crime.
He admitted he did.
He was making bombs, and he did all this stuff, carrying explosive during the commission of a felony. Carrying an explosive, not a firearm.
Yeah.
Carrying an
explosive.
So, you know, he might have had a vest on.
But you know what his problem is, though? He's mad because they labeled him a terrorist inmate.
And basically, because what they said the first 3.5 years he was in general population with the rest of the prisoners. And then he was subjected to more restrictive conditions after the prison officials designated him as a terrorist inmate in late 2006. Now, then he said he filed a lawsuit like, I want to be treated by just like everybody else, even if y'all label me a terrorist.
Okay.
But and they're not even dismissing it. This judge Royce Lambert denied the government's efforts to dismiss both cases in March, and this is against the FBI saying hey, y'all did something wrong. They said, judge, dismiss it. This man's a terrorist. You need to leave us alone. Let us do our business.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm not dismissing it. You guys are wrong. So Royer's attorney made requests for discovery in June 2013. In the months that follow, Lambert, in a January 15th order, said the Bureau's lawyers and the U.S. Attorney's Office committed a series of egregious errors. The judge cited missed deadlines, the production of discovery on a rolling basis, and the submission of information without the proper signature. And without the proper signature mean you made stuff up and just
you
and
lied.
Gave it to the court.
Yeah, you lied.
You lied. You basically came up with your evidence and said this is the way it is. But the judge is saying, I would hold a hearing in open court to hold the government accountable for their misconduct.
Exactly.
So why can't, you know, American citizens who are innocent, who haven't done anything, why can't they get a hearing?
Exactly.
Why can't Attorney General Eric Holder say, hey, you know, just because you're not a senator like Ted Stevens, I'm still going to do the right thing. Why we can't get no judge?
Judge That's Lambert, right. Judge Royce Lambert, we call it. Attention, Judge Royce Lambert, come on out to Colorado, please.
That's right.
We have a case for you here.
Teach them how to do something.
Thank you.
Now, let's go to this next one. This one is just amazing. And you know, I like the headline on it. It says, our criminal justice system has become a crime. And this article is done by Glenn Harlan Reynolds, and this appeared in USA Today. So you can look this one up online on USA Today. Our criminal justice system has become a crime. Subheading, prosecutors too often abuse unrestrained powers.
Amen.
Now, I like the way Reynolds broke this down. Says that the way the system is supposed to work, you know, a person commits a crime or is accused of committing a crime. Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then the police, they do an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Once probable cause to believe is established to point to the fact that maybe that this person is guilty, the case is taken to the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's put before a grand jury after that.
Right.
And then if the grand jury agrees that there's probable cause, then there's an indictment.
Mm-hmm.
It goes to trial, and then you got 12 ordinary citizens that hears the case. Now, that's the way it's supposed to work. He says, here's the way it actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement decides that a person is suspicious or possibly just a political enemy upon investigation into every aspect of his or her life.
Yeah.
They find possible violations of the law, often violating or often involving obscure technical statutes that no one even really knows. Then they throw the kitchen sink at them.
Yes.
And then, you know, they basically force the person into a plea deal. And so you got a situation where you've got hundreds. They sometimes throw hundreds of charges at a person just to get it down to one and make the person take a plea deal. Now, you know, Reynolds also goes on to say that, you know, framers of the Constitution, you know, built the Constitution to allow for due process. Well, due process does not happen in the real world. And it says that, you know, if a jury exercises a right and says that, no, even though there may be some hint that this person may have done something, and they find that the person is not guilty, that people have an issue with jury nullification. That's something that the law allows for. Judges don't talk about it,
right?
But the law allows for it. Yeah. And people look at that as a negative. But then when a prosecutor says, well, we're not going to bring charges, they sugarcoat it, and they call that prosecutorial discretion.
Right.
Well, you know, Reynolds, he's saying, you know, that basically bottom line is that, and he even cites Harvey Silverglate here out of his book that says three felonies a day. And basically, you know, Harvey has said that, you know, everyone walks around and in the course of a day you may commit three felonies and never even know it.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
basically this guy, he's saying, Reynolds is saying that basically prosecutors should be stripped of their absolute immunity and that, you know, that they need to be held at a higher standard as well, just like anyone else. And they should be subjected to civil damages for misconduct, you know, when they do these criminal acts of, you know, like some of the stuff
that's
we just talked about here.
That's right.
You know,
that's
and so folks need to go out and take a look at that article.
Yeah,
you know, our criminal justice system has become a crime. And, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here that, that just, you know, it makes no sense. Our whole system makes no sense.
Exactly. Talking about jury nullification.
And that's why he said also, if our criminal justice system would be a true justice system, then due process must attach at all stages. Right now, prosecutors run riot, and that needs to change.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And we have our caller on the line. We have Attorney Paul Prestia. Thank you for being with us tonight, Paul. How are you?
Cliff, Sam, Ethel, hi, how are you?
Hi,
Paul.
Doing
great.
Glad you're here.
We appreciate you coming.
That was a perfect segue into what we were going to discuss, I think.
Absolutely.
Don't you think that stuff is totally disgusting? I mean,
very appropriate. What was the name of that article? I'm going to go look that up right after we're done.
Yeah, we'll send it to you. We'll have Olivia forward that to you. But it's called Our
Even
Criminal.
Even better.
It says Our Criminal Justice System Has Become a Crime, and it's by Glenn Harlan Reynolds. And what prosecutors too often abuse unrestrained power. But we'll get that link in. It'll show what paper it came out of and all that.
Great.
Okay, so, Paul, tell us about your practice in New York, and then we'll get into talking a little bit about Khalif Browder, and then we'd like to, you know, kind of segue over into just, you know, a little bit of discussion as far as juveniles being wrongly convicted and sent to adult prisons and, you know, that whole, you know, atrocity there.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us
there's
about yourself.
There's a lot to talk about for certain. I have a criminal defense. Well, I was a prosecutor in Brooklyn, Kings County, and I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I also do civil rights litigation. So that's really where the Khalif Browder's case comes in. So I'm sort of on. I deal with a lot of young men. I deal with a lot of kids who are, in my opinion, are wrongfully accused. And sometimes, as it works out, if I'm defending them in a criminal case, if we get the case dismissed, we believe that we usually would have grounds to, that we'd usually have recourse against the city for some sort of civil rights violation, whether it be false arrest or malicious prosecution. Oftentimes, there's some excessive force in these cases. And, you know, other times I just take civil rights cases on their own. Without having any prior representation of the client in the criminal case. So they sort of go hand in hand. Obviously, not every criminal case gets dismissed, but there's certainly plenty out there that there are flaws in the prosecution.
So, Paul, where is the breakdown in the system? I mean, you know, we hear, and not to pick on New York, but we... We hear of a lot of cases of exonerees now who, you know, when they were in Khalif's situation, you know, 16 years old, 15 years old, taken down to the precinct, questioned, parents are not called, and basically scared, you know, into coerced into a plea deal, and to find out years later that this kid really didn't do it. They were just scared, and they said whatever the investigator wanted them to say. So, you know, where's the breakdown in the system?
Well, I mean, I think it starts, well, at least from my viewpoint, I think a lot of that starts in sort of how the police go about arresting people or stopping people. You know, I deal with a lot of kids in urban neighborhoods in Brooklyn and the Bronx who, for lack of a better term, are stopped because of the color of their skin, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a lot of pretextual stops. You know, if there's a young black man driving a fairly nice car in some of these neighborhoods, they're going to get pulled over. And the police are looking for a reason to stop and search your car. Or if there's a young minority riding his bicycle and there's a crime that may have taken place, you know, within hours of them seeing this young man on a bicycle, they'll legitimize the arrest by saying he was riding the bike on the sidewalk. So that's a way for them. It gives them basically, when I say pretextual, it gives them a reason to pull the people over either on a bike or in a car, some reason for them to begin that search process. They're really seizing that person without any grounds to do so. So that's where it sort of begins.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in terms of the coercion and taking the plea deals, you have to understand that a lot of these men or women or defendants are, you know, could be in on bail. Maybe they have a prior record. So the deck is sort of stacked against them. You know, they may be dealing with like a legal aid attorney, and I'm not here to, you know, or a city attorney, and I'm not here to, you know, disparage any of those attorneys because they do work hard and some of them are very good at what they do. But they may not have the time really to put into a case what normally should be put into a case. But in any event, it's not even about the attorneys, but you know, when these young people or these defendants are facing charges and they're in jail, it's very easy for them to maybe say to themselves, well, I might as well take a deal that they're offering me because I'm probably going to get convicted. Even if there isn't enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they committed a crime. Or even if maybe they didn't do anything themselves. You know, so a lot of times there's that pressure and there's that pressure to sort of just take the best deal possible because maybe there's that sense of hopelessness that there's no way they're going to be acquitted. And there's a lot of so they might as well just take the best deal possible.
Yeah.
And maybe they don't have that guidance or sense of direction. I'm not saying that about all cases, but I do see that happens. You know, every so often.
Yeah.
And obviously there are plenty of police tactics in terms of, you know, what you're saying about coercion and statements. There are plenty of police tactics that are used that, you know, can be pretty underhanded to try to get somebody to admit to something.
To get them to admit to, hey, Paul,
a lot of promises can be made inside those police precincts.
No
and
doubt.
As you know, in New York, none of the confessions are videotaped or audiotaped or recorded in any way, shape, or form other than by hand. So
yeah.
It's hard to really say what happens in those interrogation rooms sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I know, Paul, you could give us a lot of, we're going to get some more thoughts from you on that, so we want you to hold that thought. And we're going to take a quick break, and this is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Our number this evening is 347-838-8976. Joining us this evening is Paul Prestia. He is the attorney who represented Khalif Browder, who was a young man who was wrongly incarcerated in New York. Paul has a lot of experience. He's going to share with us some of his experiences, and then we're also going to talk about the Khalif Browder case and the Khalif Browder story. Don't go anywhere. Keep it locked. We'll be right back.
It's Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Got Sam Thurman, joined by me, Cliff Stewart, and Ethel Lopez here tonight. We're talking about a bunch of things we have on the show. Attorney Paul Prestia, we just heard the short exoneree moment about his client.
Yeah.
And the things that this young man went through as a teenager, spending all this time in prison. If you have questions for us or for Paul, you can reach us 347-838-8976. And if you're just listening in, we want you to take a moment, go out to change.org, do a search for IRP6 and change and sign that petition that we have about those over 200 pages of missing transcript. Paul, before we went to the break, you know, you were talking about all the things that in New York, you know, some of the things that you see as a defense attorney, and you had talked about, you know, how the police, they come up, they pull over minority young men if a crime has been committed, pretty much, you know, carte blanche. If there was a crime committed, you were in the vicinity, you might just get charged with it. And if I recall, wasn't a law passed?
Or even if you're in a, you know, a particular neighborhood, you could be pulled over.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a crime that's been committed. You know, they can just pull you over and come up with a reason for doing so that you, you know, maybe didn't signal, or they'll say that, you know, you ran a red light, something
right,
to get
right.
a car to begin a search. But in any event.
Yeah, wasn't a law passed in New York about, you know, racial profiling to try to get that stopped? What's your take on that law and what effect it has had, okay. basically, in the area? Yeah, basically the stop and frisk
right,
law.
Yeah.
What has that done from your opinion and from your viewpoint, you know, in the state or in some of those different areas that you're talking about?
I don't think it's been really in effect long enough to see much of a difference just yet.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the statistics will sort of play that out as we go forward. But, I mean, it seems to be the right idea. Whether it's done in practice is obviously something that remains to be seen.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Why Rikers Island? Why did they send this kid to Rikers Island? Is that the only place they could have sent him? They shouldn't have sent him anywhere, but why Rikers Island?
Well, that's the main detainee, that's the main inmate facility for New York City Corrections. And I believe that has basically the juvenile capacity to house the juveniles in. So that seems to have been the logical place to send him.
Oh.
And that's the largest facility, obviously, in the city
mm-hmm.
as well. However, it doesn't appear that he really spent much time in actually the juvenile facility itself.
Right.
For very long. He was quickly transferred to solitary confinement, where he spent upwards of almost 800 days and nights. 800 days and nights as a teenager in solitary.
Wow.
Yeah. And the point of it, and even New York, just recently, I believe it was February 20th or 21st of this year, just outlawed solitary confinement for those under 18, which, you know, Khalif epitomized why that should have been made law. Unfortunately for him, he was not in jail when the law passed, but it's just, to me, there's no logic in the solitary confinement laws as it is. I mean, to me, it's tantamount to child abuse. If you put someone, you know, 16, 17 years old in solitary confinement, that's no way to rehabilitate them. To me, it's just more punishment. You know, if you lock a 16-year-old boy or girl in their room, or your son or your daughter in their room for 23 hours out of one day, which solitary confinement is, they're only allowed out 1 hour a day.
Mm-hmm.
If you do that to someone, to your child,
mm-hmm.
you'd be arrested for endangering the welfare of a child.
Absolutely.
Right. Absolutely.
And that's just one day. And remember, the cells in solitary confinement aren't furnished with comfy quilts and blankets and stuffed animals and TVs,
mm-hmm.
you know, like your son or daughter might have. Mm-hmm. So,
right. And
I
even
mean, you could,
the
yeah, I mean,
I'll
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. We might have a little delay, but I just want to say, you know, we did on the show before about solitary confinement, and you know, the international community calls solitary confinement torture. You know, and when you look at it and you look at how America just uses it, I mean, pretty much everybody. You do anything. Oh, you didn't feel like combing your hair this morning. You said you had a problem with the food, with the fact that we gave you raw chicken as a meal. You're going to solitary. And the rest of the world says, you know, this is torture. This is what you would do to somebody if they had committed a military crime and you were basically, you know, breaking the Geneva Act and trying to get some information out of this man. And you know, we saw people who were in solitary confinement 20, 25 years of their life. And how does that rehabilitate somebody? The article we were looking at said that it basically drives a person insane. And even we had, was that here in Colorado where one of the lawmakers or something? He spent
the new director of the Colorado Department of Corrections.
Yeah, he spent time in solitary confinement and almost went totally crazy.
What, 23 hours?
Yeah, 23 hours, just one day in solitary, and he was like, he could not take it. He was losing his mind. He was going crazy. This is one day, and we're talking about keeping people there decades on end.
That is amazing.
Yeah, and to me, it's just shocking that someone would give corrections officers the authority and discretion to arbitrarily put people in these cells in solitary confinement. And if you think about it from a different perspective, and I'll get to Khalif in a moment, because what he went through in solitary is unimaginable. I mean, it's horrific. But in any event, this thing about solitary confinement, that they have this discretion to do that, these corrections officers, and not only to... In the inmates that I'm not sure how it is in your jurisdiction, but in Rikers Island, the vast majority of the inmates at Rikers Island have not been convicted of a crime. If you're convicted in New York City of a crime and your sentence is 1 year or less, you'll serve that sentence in Rikers Island.
Right.
But if you get a sentence of more than 1 year, they send you upstate. So the far majority of those people in Rikers Island, while some of them are serving a sentence of less than 1 year, a year or less, that they've received in criminal or Supreme Court or criminal court, the vast majority of them are only accused. So they're accused of a crime, just accused, not convicted.
Right.
Compelled to sit in jail on bail or whatever the case might be. And yet on top of that, they're punished even further by being thrown into solitary. And in Khalif's case, it was for months at a time.
Wow.
And, you know, Paul, I'm looking at another story here, and I think this came out around this one just came out, but it's making reference to what you were stating earlier, that the state of New York has made some changes with regard to solitary confinement and as it pertains to youth. And you're probably familiar with this, but there's a young man by the name of Ishmael Nazario. Mm-hmm. And it says that he spent time in Rikers Island on assault and robbery charges, and without being convicted, he spent 300 days in solitary confinement. He said that, you know, his eyes started playing tricks on him. He started seeing black dots. He was focusing on the dots, started pacing back and forth. You only have a little slot in the door that you can scream through, and it was like... He's saying that he was trying to escape from seeing the black dots, and that this was just, like you said, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, not having been subjected to that, you look at it and it's like you have adult men who are corrections officers, and I say that, you know, sarcastically, that are basically abusing kids.
Yeah.
And like you said, I don't know if they're getting their kicks off of doing that, but anybody else walking the street,
yeah.
You start beating up on your kid is going to get taken away from you. You're going to jail, and you're going to do some serious time. So what gives them the right to do this to a kid that charges are pending? They haven't been convicted of anything.
Right.
They've been accused. I mean, that's just as bad as, you know, the word indictment. You know, just because someone has been indicted or accused of something, that doesn't mean that they did it.
Yeah.
But people treat them as though they're guilty.
And to that, Sam, also the word legally, they can do it legally because they're the ones in charge. You know, that is ridiculous, totally.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously oftentimes it's done illegally, but whatever they need to do to make it appear legal, they do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you ever heard Khalif articulate, and obviously I've spent a lot of time with him, what he went through,
mm-hmm.
being in solitary confinement, being deprived of his meals, and just imagine a 17-year-old kid in a 6x8 cell with maybe a magazine or two, and a growing young man, a kid, being deprived of 4 or 5 meals in a row. That's all they have to look forward to.
Yeah.
And you're in a cell like that. I mean, not that the meals are any good, but at least it's something to look forward to. And being starved like that. And, well, Khalif attempted suicide several times himself.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, an interesting point in this case is that on one occasion, in March of 2012, Khalif attempted suicide. He was basically about to hang himself from a bedsheet, if I can be frank with you, and candid. And corrections officers came in, beat him up, I guess is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
They really beat him up. I mean, they gave it to him good. It was almost like a way to punish them for acting out. You know, this was one way they would try to, maybe they thought it was better than getting psychiatric treatment. You know, that was their own way of, therapeutic way of handling things. But in any event, they beat him up, and a couple of months later, you know, basically punished him for trying to kill himself, which, you know, at this point, Khalif had serious psychological damage just from his time in solitary confinement, as you can imagine. And Khalif was actually charged for assaulting the corrections officers.
Wow.
On that date. Yeah. He was charged criminally. Months later, he was charged for this March 12th assault on corrections officers. And he was charged criminally, charged with assaulting a corrections officer. And interestingly enough, that case got dismissed against Khalif also. How about that?
Oh
man, this is a sickening story. When you're thinking about this is a 16-year-old kid and, you know, being a sophomore in high school, this is real, real bad.
Paul, we got to take another break. We appreciate you, you know, getting deep into this with us. And I'm sure there are some folks out there, just like we are sitting here right now, just kind of stunned by some of the things that we're hearing. Our number this evening for callers, if you'd like to call in, if you have a question for Paul or even a comment, you know, at this point, you know, I feel like, you know, people need to call in and at least express some support for Khalif. Our number is 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. Paul, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening, Paul Prestia, attorney for Khalif Browder. We'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976, 347-838-8976. Shout out to beyondbars.org, beyondbars.org for that piece that we just heard. You know, when you hear statistics like that, you know, one in every black male child, every black born in this country, you know, can expect to spend some time in jail. You know, it's like the deck is stacked against them before they're even born. I mean, you know, 30% is going to go to jail before, you know, at some point.
Of an entire race.
Of an entire race.
Not just, you know, the black guys in this neighborhood or this state or this city. No, the whole country, yeah. One in three.
Man,
my son is 13. Why is either he or one of his two friends going to go to prison just because they happen to be born in
Cliff,
America?
Ethel, if people don't get involved and get, you know, become advocates for correcting some of this mess that's going on, man, it's just going to continue to go down the drain. But, you know, that's why,
exactly.
You know, organizations like A Just Cause exist. And a lot of the other organizations that are out there, and you know, we're all seeking to reach the same goal.
Exactly.
I mean, this kind of stuff, when the numbers crunch like that, it's sick.
Yeah.
Joining us this evening, Paul Prestia. He is the attorney for Khalif Browder, the young man who went to Rikers Island in New York, was incarcerated, and held in solitary confinement, and then mysteriously released from prison. With no charges, and you know, Paul, again, welcome to the program.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I find, of course, one of the things that I find interesting as well is the judge. You know, after Khalif had been incarcerated for 33 months, and then a judge offers him a plea deal, and basically based on time served, and Khalif turned it down, and said no, he wanted to prove his innocence, and he was facing. By turning it down, he was facing 15 years in prison. So, you know, this young man, I mean, you got to say that, hey, he stood up for the fact that I didn't do anything wrong.
Exactly.
You know, I'm being subjected to all kinds of mess here in solitary confinement and otherwise, but I didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, you know, he spent 5 more months in jail, and then all, you know, strange things started to happen. So what was going on there, Paul, you know, when they just, you know, all of a sudden he's being released and all of the plea deal and all that kind of stuff. What was going on there?
Well, I did not represent Khalif in his criminal case, but, you know, we reviewed the criminal court file to the extent that we could have or that we've been able to so far in this case, to the extent that we have it. But, you know, that's something that is not out of the ordinary, that a judge is trying to make that deal, that a judge is trying to get that case off his or her calendar, trying to make that deal to get a disposition and get the case finished and over with. Now, quite honestly, Khalif probably could have walked in not too long after his arrest in the court, taken a deal in 2010, and gotten less than 3 years in jail easily based on his lack of criminal record and his age. He certainly would have got less than 3 years, I believe, on some reduced charge. But, yeah, well, he goes in January, and the judge offers him a deal basically to get rid of the case. He says no. And, you know, I think it came to a point where, in my opinion, another judge stepped in and actually took some interest in the case and made sure, basically demanded that the district attorney produce this witness, this supposed victim, or dismiss the case. And then that's ultimately what happened, or who knows how much longer this would have gone on for.
Okay.
Yeah, and the strange thing is, when did, you know, it's the DA's job to try to offer plea deals. Why is the judge jumping in and saying, okay, I'm going to offer you, I'm going to let you go if you plead guilty? That's not even the judge's place. That the judge is supposed to be the referee. Mm-hmm. Why does the judge say, if you plead guilty, we'll go ahead and let you go so we can have, I can, like you say, I can get this off my docket. I can get my my guilty verdict. We'll give you probation, probably 5 years. You'll have a record until that 5 years is over. Why is the judge even stepping in? That is just totally ridiculous. What the judge should have said, you know what, son? The DA doesn't have any witness against you. He's not presented me with any evidence. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and let you go home because this is ridiculous. They're breaking the law. They're bringing a reproach against the legal system. Mm-hmm. We're going to go ahead and let you out so you can be with your family. That's judge. What should have happened.
And not only that, Cliff, you know, it says that he went to court on several occasions, but he was never even scheduled for a trial.
Like, what did they take him to court for? Just to try to get him to plea? I mean, what were they taking him there for?
My understanding is this. He did go to court several times. He went to court almost 30 times.
Wow.
Sometimes when he was brought from solitary confinement, he was handcuffed and shackled by the feet. Brought to court each and every time. In my review of the file, and ready to go to trial and proclaim his innocence, he never got that chance. Because, from what I can discern from the file, the district attorney's office delayed the case some more in hopes maybe that he would take a plea at some point. Because, you know, when you're sitting in jail,
yeah,
and it's wearing on you, it's much easier to just give in and give up.
Yeah.
Take
yeah,
that deal just yeah, to go home. So I really commend Khalif for not taking that plea. And he really... You know, listen, honestly, obviously he's been affected by all this, by what he went through. But, you know, I don't want to get into, you know, our relationship too much or any of, like, my personal conversations with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you this. He actually received his GED. I saw the piece that you did. He graduated. He got his GED last week.
Awesome.
And I really think he should be commended for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's quite an accomplishment. He's gotten his security license, and he's looking for work. And you know, the thing about what he went through is, and I think people need to realize, is he could have easily been released from jail. Now remember, he was arrested when he was 16, a 16-year-old boy, and he came out in the body of a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But mentally, he was still in his teens.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't receive an education. They deprived him of that too while he was in Rikers.
Yeah.
So he lost out on a lot. You can talk about the prom and those memories and, yeah, listen, those nights not being able to wake up in his own home, you know, on Christmas morning, you know, you can't even begin to appreciate what he went through.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, and again, he can articulate this much better than I can. But my point was that he could have easily been released in the mental. In the mindset that he was in, and with the pain, torment, anger, and resentment that he felt leaving there after all those years and all that he's lost, and he could have easily went home and, you know, probably made some bad decisions in his life, you know,
right,
with that pain and anger, you know, in his heart. But he really, I'm really proud that he took it one day at a time, as much of a struggle as it's been for him, and I know it has been, to go forward and get his GED and try to make something of you know, what happened to him.
And, you know, Paul, I know you said you're not going to get into a lot of the, you know, personal conversations that you and Khalif have had, but, you know, I think everyone can pick up on
aside from the fact that they're, you know, attorney-client privilege conversation.
Oh, yeah.
But, right,
yeah,
you know,
of course.
I mean.
Of course. No, but what I was going to say, Paul, is that there's an obvious emotional connection.
Mm-hmm.
between you and Khalif in this case. I mean, because you can just sense the sincere concern that you have for Khalif, and that, you know, you're, you know, it's an atrocity as far as what happened to this young man, and and it sounds like you're, you know, you're giving him a little bit of a guidance along the way as well, you know, as to, you know, how to possibly get, you know, recoup some of the things that were stolen from him. I'm not going to say things that he lost. I mean, it was literally stolen from him. I mean, any one of us can look back in our life and recall, you know, what we did between the ages of 16 and 20.
Right.
There is a lot of stuff that happens in those years. But to think that you're sitting in a, you know, an 8x6 cell in solitary confinement. And, you know, Paul, we did a piece on the Angola 3 a while back, one of the Angola 3, you know, gave the description of that type of cell. And basically, he referred to it as a parking lot space. And so, you know, and so I like to put it out there for the listeners. Imagine going to your local Walmart and look at the size of a parking space. And that is what you have to be confined to for 23 hours out of a day for 3 years. I mean, that has to do some emotional damage to a person.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. No, I mean, listen, I obviously, you know, I'm very passionate towards all my clients, but obviously with Khalif, you know, I try to spend as much time as I can, and there's perhaps I've taken on like a mentor approach with him, you know, just spend time with him and grab lunch with him and try to see him like once a week and just check in with him and, you know, just try to keep him positive, you know, the best I can. And, you know, we talk about a lot of things. It's not just, you know, he just doesn't come to my office to sign paperwork. You know, I've really gotten to know him really well. And, you know, I can... Certainly, I can never, you know, I can never know what he went through. But I just try to tell him that, you know, sometimes in life things happen and we need to, you know, at some point just, you know, take it one day at a time and, you know, move forward and make the best of the situation that we're dealt, you know, and, you know, amongst other things, but... You know, I try to spend time with him and, you know, stay involved with him. And, you know, he's a good kid. He's a good kid.
Hey, Paul, let us...
Whatever I can do to help him and to get him into, like, a program or help him get work or whatever the case might be, you know, where... And obviously, he's in counseling, which is very important. But, you know, we try to just stay in touch as much as we can.
Yeah. Hey, Paul, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, we're going to get some closing thoughts from you on this case and cut you loose. But if you can hang out through this break, we would appreciate it. Our number this evening, 347-838-8976. 347-838-8976. We appreciate the fact that Paul Prestia, the attorney for Khalif Browder, is with us this evening. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. We'll be right back after this. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us this evening is Paul Prestia, attorney for Khalif Browder, the young man in New York who was wrongly incarcerated and spent a lot of time, most of his time in solitary confinement, was recently released, and Paul is representing Khalif on the civil lawsuit against New York. And, you know, Paul, we you know, through the breaks, we've just been sitting here and just kind of shaking our heads and just talking about, you know, how tragic this situation is. And fortunately, you know, that Khalif has an attorney like yourself that's representing him and helping to, you know, be a mentor to him. You know, we're just, again, just talking about you know, how important that is.
And Paul, you know, as far as... like his family situation. If it's something you can't get into, then that's fine. But, you know, we just want to let the audience know, you know, as far as any of his, if he has siblings, how they're doing, how they dealt with it, if his his parents, whoever his guardians are, how they dealt with this. And you know, obviously they got to be happy that he's out, but, you know, how are things going on that front?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. Of course they're happy, they're relieved that he's home, but I'll just say, I think it obviously was, it took a toll on his family.
Mm-hmm.
At the time that he was in, you know, I believe it was difficult for them, as it's understandable, of course.
Right, right. Yeah, because you got to feel helpless. You know, you got a 16-year-old kid locked up, and, you know, every time if they got a chance to talk to him, when they got a chance to talk to him while he's locked up and hearing the things that he went through, I mean, it's a tragic story. But then to be the person that, you know, all of us who have kids, you want to feel like you're able to protect them if they get in trouble, that, you know, they get in a dangerous situation, mm-hmm. that, you know, you can rescue them if they're in trouble on their own from something they did wrong. It's like, you know what, you need to learn a lesson. But when it's wrong that they're incarcerated, and then, you know, they've got them in there with full grown men, then put him in solitary confinement for all that time. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, you can only imagine, like, oh, the pain and the grief that the family had to feel. And like you said, obviously now they're happy that he's home, but I'm sure that did take a toll. As far as the lawsuit is going, can you get into much of that? You know, I understand that since it is ongoing, there are some aspects of it that you can't address, but as far as, like, you know, what you guys are going after, or the type of, you know, basically what you're suing for, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Well, I mean, the crux of our lawsuit is that, you know, the city of New York and its agent, namely the New York City Police Department, the New York City Department of Corrections, and the Bronx District Attorney's Office violated several of his constitutional rights, whether it be the false arrest and imprisonment, the malicious prosecution, the denial of his constitutional right to a fair and speedy trial, deprivation of his education. I mean, I can go on and on.
Right.
I mean, what's startling to me is that there was just such a clear manipulation by the district attorney's office of the speedy trial laws in this case, but that kept him in there that long. Because theoretically, in New York, on a felony, the prosecution, or the people, as they're called, have 6 months to be ready for trial.
Right.
The time of threat. In this case, you know, when I speak to people, they're like, well, how did they get 3 years? Well, it's a little tactic that's used, like, every day in courthouses around in the city. It's used every day by prosecutors in every courthouse. Mm-hmm. And I see it every day. I'm a defense attorney, and I'm sure my colleagues see it every day. And basically what they do is they walk into court on the day that the case is on for trial. And they tell the judge, when the judge asks the district attorney, are you ready for trial? The DA says, judge, we're not ready today, but we can be ready in 1 week. Judge says, okay, I'll put it over for a month from now or 6 weeks from now. Now, that's what happened. But the district attorney's office for that case is only charged 1 week in terms of speedy trial time. And do you see, like, the tactic?
Oh, yeah.
Right, right. That's
even though the case is adjourned for 6 weeks,
right,
the district attorney is only charged. It's only 1 week is applied towards the speedy trial time. And that's how they sort of circumvent the system.
That is so
They kidnapped him.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they kidnapped
the
him.
The problem is, like I said, it happens all the time. But when someone's incarcerated, that cannot go on. I mean, the fact that it went on, and I kid you not, this happened. In one instance, the case was on for trial on August 24th, I believe, 2011. And the district attorney said, we're not ready. We'll be ready in a week. The judge adjourned it till November 4th, 2011.
My goodness, man.
Almost 2.5 months later. The district attorney got charged a week.
And while,
right.
while
and that happened shit. Over and over in this case, over and over and over, the district attorney found every reason not to be ready in this case. When in reality, this is one of the most simple cases to try before a jury. This is not. Let me remind you and your listeners: this is not a complex drug conspiracy filled with wiretaps and search warrants. Mm-hmm. Right? This is not some multi-defendant racketeering case in federal court when there are boxes of evidence. No. This, all that needed to happen at this trial is the police officer would testify that he made an arrest, and the victim would testify that Khalif was the one that robbed him.
Right.
And it couldn't be more simple than that. And then perhaps, you know, this is a one-witness robbery case. Perhaps the defendant, in this case, Khalif, would have testified. I'm sure he would have. But that's all it is. All it is. It wasn't that hard. You know what I mean?
And they violated
every civil right. It's completely shocking to me that this could have happened. And it's unfathomable. It's beyond ridiculous. Mm-hmm. It's laughable that the district attorney, who's supposed to uphold, diligently prosecute cases, and mm-hmm. has a duty to promote justice, could let this happen. There's hundreds of assistant district attorneys working in the Bronx. Hundreds. No one could have came in if the district attorney was on vacation and couldn't be ready for trial, or the district attorney or the ADA who was prosecuting the case was on another trial, so he couldn't do Khalif's trial. No one else could have stepped in and done that case. I could have done that case in my first day in the DA's office in Brooklyn. I would have lost, but you know what? Anyone who tried that case, this case, Khalif Browder's case, would have lost. He would have been acquitted in 5 minutes.
Right, and justice would
based
have been.
Based on the evidence in this case.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know what, Paul?
It's an atrocity, really.
Absolutely it is. And, you know, speaking about the civil suit that you guys have, you know, we had talked to some of the guys from the Central Park Five, and, you know, they're going, I mean, it's been over 10 years their battle with the state trying to get some type of, you know, you can't really call it compensation, but trying to get something, some type of closure that says at least the city can do something for the fact that they kept us locked up. And, you know, what is up with this drawn out process that New York has with, and I guess it's not just New York, the whole, every time somebody gets out, they go through, you know, this drawn out process. And I think they said on average it's 3 years that somebody has to deal with it before they get, monetary compensation for being wrongfully convicted.
That's just the system. That's just the system, unfortunately. That's the civil process for you. It's slow for sure. I mean, why it's that way? I don't know. It's a very good question. I can't answer that. You'd have to find out from the city why it takes so long for them to settle these cases or go to trial with them. But they do tend to sit around for quite some time.
You know, it's totally.
Obviously there are thousands of cases that are filed
right, but
in a year,
but like you said, just like you said, you know, there's thousands of cases, there's hundreds of district attorneys there to deal with them. I'm sure, you know, once a judge says this person isn't, they aren't guilty, we got to let them go. It's over. You guys were wrong. You should never have incarcerated them. That it is not a difficult proposition to say, hey, for each year this person spent, you give them this amount for every one of their civil rights violations that we have. Mm-hmm. Hey, we'll settle on this amount. I'm sure you could get in front of them and you guys could settle this in a week. Mm-hmm. But of course, they aren't gonna get you in front of anybody that fast. It's like you said, it's an atrocity that it happened to this kid, mm-hmm. and now Khalif and his family. You know, as a kid, now he's trying to recuperate in his mind. He's trying to figure out what's going on, and the city's going to draw it out more and more. It is totally, totally ridiculous. But like you said, you know, it happens all the time. We need to try to put a stop to it. You know, and that's why we as a Just Cause, you know, are trying to align with other organizations to say, hey, let's do something about these injustices. Let's do something about the whole process that just strings you along forever. I mean, we're working on a case right now dubbed it the IRP6 case, where we have six IT executives. They've been wrongfully convicted. They've got over 200 pages of their trial transcript. Is missing, and the judge will not release them. They've been locked up for over 20 months, and it's like, how do we even get a proper appeal if you've got over 200 pages of the transcripts that you're holding on to? And by the way, this 200 pages of transcript is where the judge is violating their Fifth Amendment right, basically telling them one of you are going to have to take this stand, or I'm going to close your case for you. And, you know, obviously there, a judge would be like, well, no, I don't want to release that. That's some very damaging evidence for me. So it is every time we look at the system, every time we come up with something, it never ceases to amaze me how corrupt things are. And, you know, you just got to call it like it is. You can say, well, they got a heavy caseload. But when you really get down to the nitty-gritty, to what's really going on, the system is corrupt. They don't want to do anything right. And then when they get caught, they don't want to have accountability for what they did. And, you know, just like this judge in the case with Khalif, just like the judge saying, why don't you take a plea deal because you could spend 15 years in jail. That's not your place. Okay. And it never should have been done. But, you know, that's part of the whole head is corrupt. The whole thing needs to be chopped off. And, you know, you can't grow a new head, so rebuild the system. Mm. Yeah, bury it. Exactly.
Right.
Well, right. Paul Prestia, attorney for Khalif Browder. Paul, we want to, you know, thank you for joining us this evening and sharing your thoughts about the system in general. I mean, you shed some incredible light on just how the system works in general. And then the getting heart to heart and deep into some of the thoughts on the Khalif Browder case. Paul, we're going to post a profile about you and the case out there on our website. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, we ask that you would pass on our thoughts and concerns to Khalif and his family. And, you know, this is, like you said just a moment ago, it's an atrocity as to the tactics that are employed in some of the cases, and particularly, you know, with Khalif Browder, the way he was treated as a young kid. And so, again, you know, pass along our thoughts and prayers to Khalif. And we really appreciate what you're doing. You know, you sound like a man that's I was reading here on your website. It says that you're the people's lawyer, and you fight hard to get the right result for each of the clients, you know. I know that's a piece, but it sounds like it comes out in everything you say.
Well, you know what? I try to relate to each one of my clients on some level. You know, I think that's important, and so I, you know, it's always interesting, and I think you know, I try to do the right thing by them, for sure.
Yeah. And Paul,
because,
you know, we have
some of the things you hear, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, definitely.
You know what happens to them. So sometimes they need a voice as well.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, we have listeners all over the country. And so if someone happens to be in New York and they need a good attorney, how can they get in contact with you? I know you,
I'll
you know.
I'll take care of them. I'll take care of them for sure.
Yeah.
Well, they can just give me a call or just send me an email and we'll talk.
Okay, they can go to PrestiaLaw.com. That's www.PrestiaLaw.com. The spelling on that is PrestiaLaw, PrestiaLaw. Again, that's www.PrestiaLaw.com. Paul Prestia, thank you, sir, for joining us.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you for having us. You know, this is the most important story right now, in my opinion, that's not really being talked about. So I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about it. And believe it or not, there's probably more that I could tell you about this story, but we'll leave it at that for now, I guess.
Hey, we'll have you come back. We will definitely have you come back and get Khalif on here as well.
Because, you know, if you think about it, if you deconstruct the criminal justice system in this case and you take it apart at every level, from the NYPD's unlawful arrest of Khalif to the malicious prosecution by the DA's office to his incarceration at Rikers Island and the abuse he faced there, it's just a massive failing. It should almost be called a system of injustice. I haven't mentioned the judges, but that's for another time. In any event,
right. Well, hey, you know what, Paul? You're welcome here on the program at any time.
Absolutely.
And you know, we can work something out with Olivia and get you back on as soon as we can. You're welcome here on our program at any time.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for the time.
Have a good evening.
It. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Keep it locked. We'll be right back in a moment.
Peace.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Ethel Lopez and Cliff Stewart. You know, we always learn a lot from the different people that we have here on the program. And so, you know, with Paul Prestia being on and talking about Khalif and just the things that go on there in New York, very, very eye-opening, very enlightening.
It really was, yes. It really was.
So, Ethel, you got something there that you wanted to...
Yeah, this is an interview with Carl Dix, and this was in the Revolution newspaper. And Carl Dix is an initiator of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. This is entitled, "The System Says Black Life Has No Value. There Must Be a Response." And A Just Cause is not about whites. It's not about blacks. It's not about, you know, anything of that nature. But we understand that when you're looking at the judicial system, when you're looking at the prisons, we know as African Americans that there are more of us in prison than there are any other race of people. And this man is talking in this conversation with Revolution magazine or newspaper, excuse me. He talks about the trial, the Don trial, and the murder of Jordan Davis. He talks about what happened with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. And he says this was the system declaring that black life has no value. As a black person, that bothers me. No, you know,
absolutely.
That really, really bothers me. I have children, you know, and I don't want to see what happened to these kids happen to my kids or any other kids, whether they are black or white. But he goes on to say in this piece, he says that it's unacceptable that whether people live and how they live can be determined by the color of their skin. This is something that must not be accepted. And he says that this shows us why we need a revolution, why we have to get rid of this system, because you're talking about brutality and oppression that has been built into the fabric of the American capitalist system from the very beginning. He says there's a lot of questions out there among people about why does this happen? Where does this come from? And what, if anything, can be done about it? And that's a discussion, he says, that needs to be unleashed very broadly in society. And we got to be right in the middle of it, bringing out why does it happen, where does it come from, and how it flows from the very operations of this system. Because when you look at the history of black people in this country, he says it's always been a thing of being integrated into and ground up under the process of the production of profit in this country. In the beginning, it was enslavement and being worked from can't see in the morning to can't see at night. You know, and that's kind of the thing, you know, because with enslavement, even if you're looking at the prison system right now, that is a form of modern day slavery.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at it. It is a form of modern day slavery. And this is me talking that it's a form of modern day slavery.
Well, no, I mean, it's not just you talking. I mean, share in that
the
thought.
The prison system, it's a complex. It's about making profit.
Yes.
And it's even in our Constitution that, you know, even though the 13th Amendment said that slavery is over, there is a section
except.
In there that says except when you're in prison.
Absolutely.
And so it's like, yeah, there's no more slavery as long as we don't lock you up. If we lock you up, you're basically a slave. And
yeah.
And so that in itself is sickening, because when you look at the prison system and you see they're being treated exactly like slaves.
Exactly.
They basically work for free. They're locked in cages. They're fed slop.
That's
and
right.
They don't get to make any decisions. And if you run away, you know, it's like we're going to bring you back and we're going to beat you and then we're going to electrocute you.
And going back to the thing with Khalif Brower, how many white kids have you heard of such a situation, something like this happening to? I have not. And when you're talking about young African American boys, this happens on a constant to these kids.
Yep.
You know, at,
yep.
at 13, 14, 15. Look at the back in what they said 80 years ago when mm-hmm. they electrocuted this 14-year-old kid. Give me a break.
And the thing is, I mean, depending on what the neighborhood I'm from, we were used to, you know, the cops. Yeah, from the time you were tall enough to, and you knew to run from the police, there's a reason we ran.
Yeah.
And, you know, these are the stories that we hear that have come out, you know, because Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis have been killed. But with all of the wrongdoing that the police do to young black boys, I mean, it's been happening as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
I mean, they used to take guys in my neighborhood. It was like, don't get caught by this certain sheriff department. They'll take you up in the caves, and they beat you on the bottom of your feet.
Absolutely.
Trying to get information out of you. That was just a known thing. And when you're a kid, it doesn't process in your mind that this is wrong and I should fight against it.
Exactly.
As adults, we should look at this is a crime against any person.
Yeah.
No matter what color their skin, no matter where they live,
yeah.
no matter what their economic standing is,
exactly.
this is wrong. It is not justice, and that's what we should fight for.
And you yeah. know, as we're talking about this subject, and we played this piece, now, if that doesn't make you take note, and I guess yeah. it was a Freudian slip on my part. I said one in every black man.
We all get
it feels like that.
Oh, yeah.
It feels
yeah,
like that. It's like, is every black man going to get locked up? But anyway, you know, one in every three black men can expect to go to prison.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's
yeah.
like it's
something's
like,
wrong with that.
It's like, don't it's totally. Go outside and be seen by law enforcement if you're a black man
yeah.
or you're in trouble. And, you know, part of that clip, you know, the narrator was saying there's a racial bias in the justice system.
Yeah.
And that's not just us saying it. That's
exactly.
That's not just that clip saying, you know, that, like she said, those are the facts. Those are the stats.
Definitely.
And I remember Mark Garagos made that statement. And I thought it was, a very courageous thing for a person that's not black to say, you know, there's a racial bias against black people in the justice system.
Paul just said it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, okay, we know this.
Mm-hmm.
Attorneys know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the judges know it. The attorney general knows it.
Ooh.
The president knows it. When he
yes.
got up there and said, "That's a black man, are you going to have to fight harder?" Well, yeah.
Why?
It's like, why? Why? Exactly. Why? And why aren't we trying to do something to fix that? Why is it just accepted? You're a black man. You got to fight harder. You're going to go to jail. They're going to lock you up for no reason. Why is that?
Thank
and
you.
Why with the most powerful office in the world?
Exactly.
How do you make that statement and feel like that's okay to
yeah.
tell your people that?
And, you know, even with the Kalief Browder story here, it says that Browder's case highlights more than racial injustice in our society. It says the $10,000 bail set for his case was morally outrageous. Not only do such steep bails discriminate against impoverished individuals like those in Browder's family, but they are often applied in cases where their use is excessive.
Mm. And, you know, on that, the thing that you were talking about also is, you know, on the why,
mm-hmm.
you know, it was brought to my attention, you know, yesterday, you know, just a clip out of the movie Roots, out of that documentary series.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when Fiddler, you know, went to Kunta Kinte and he said, "You're in America now."
Yeah, okay.
You know, I'm not going to go through the whole phrase there, but anyone who's familiar with it, they know what was said in the movie.
We know what you're talking about.
And the fact is, it was brought to my attention. It's like, take note of the expression on Kunta's face
yeah.
when I said it to him. It's
mm-hmm.
like, why is it that because I am now on soil, I was kidnapped,
mm-hmm.
and I'm on soil other than my native country,
mm-hmm.
why do I have to change my name because I'm in a different culture?
Definitely.
Why do I have to change my identity?
Yeah.
You know, and so the same thing applies even today.
Yeah.
You know, like we say, you know, why can't we just be ourselves and achieve, you know, higher heights without, you know, changing our identity.
Exactly.
You know, people and the outrageous number of black men that are going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
You go to prison and you become
a number.
Yeah,
that's it.
You know, you don't even have a name.
That's
here,
right.
Here's your slave stamp.
Yeah, you okay?
Man. So any.
Yeah,
it upsets you.
Yeah, it does.
You know,
yeah.
A Just Cause Coast to Coast education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice.
Injustice.
You know, we ask that you would pray for our brothers, the IRP6, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Kendrick Barnes, Clinton Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. At the top of the program, we talked about our breaking news where on last Thursday we did a protest in front of the Marriott downtown Denver, where Judge Christine Arguello was being inducted into the Colorado Women's Hall of Fame. And we made a statement there.
Ain't that a shame?
And we got a lot of people who signed up on the petition. We had over 100 people who were participating in the march. Folks just came off the street and started joining in as well. But if you'd like to participate, we ask you to go out to change.org, do a search on IRP6. We ask you to sign that petition. For more information about the IRP6, please go to freetheirp6.org. For more information about a just cause, go to a-justcause.com. We also ask that you click on the donate button. For more information about A Just Cause Radio, go to AJC Radio. And then also Live 365. And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Ethel, how, in addition to the petition, how are we asking people to help with the IRP6 story?
We are asking you to continue to reach out. Call Attorney General Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 and 2005 and ask him to investigate what is happening with that missing transcript. There's over 200 pages missing.
All right. And we want to first off say happy 50th birthday to our brother, Dave Zappolo of the IRP6. He turned 50
yesterday.
Dave. Want to tell him happy birthday. We're coming to get you soon, brother.
Oh, yeah.
All the brothers have spent too many birthdays in
that's
prison.
Right. Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely. We want to say thank you to our guest, Paul Prestia, attorney for Khalif Browder. We also want to say to Khalif Browder, our exoneree, congratulations on receiving your GED and getting your security certificate so that you can get to work and do the things that you need to do that will help you in your future. To our production team, K&D Productions, Captain Kyle, Dustin Jackson, helping out Ilskilla's girl in the back. If it wasn't for them, you would not hear us. Also, to our production support team, they give us the things that we need to be able to put on the show that we put on. We want to say thank you to all of you. To the truth, we know that you're out there, and we appreciate it.
And again, I just want to say to the audience out there, you've heard this program tonight. You know what's going on. You know that they're sitting in prison for no reason whatsoever. We're asking you to get up and do something. Take a stand. Make a move. Why do we continuously, as black people, need to be sitting behind bars? Why do we continuously need to be being enslaved every day for no reason? We have families. We have lives. Reach out. Do something. Sign the petition. Call Eric Holder's office. We need your help now.
Absolutely need it now. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Thank you for joining us each week. You can be with us each Tuesday and Thursday right here on AJC Radio Network. Well, I guess that's another wrap, y'all.
All right, then.
All right, going to say good night, America.
Good night, y'all.
You guys have a good night.
Talk, news, politics, and inspiration.